to season 4 of the podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. If you've never listened to my podcast before, then welcome to you, and please hit that subscribe button. It's hugely beneficial to us podcasters. As many of you know, I wrote my autobiography as a survivor of human trafficking called Custom Justice, but if you didn't know, you do now. Keeping in line with that, this entire season has been focused on interviewing other people who did or plan to write about their own experiences as trauma survivors and how they overcame their past. As much as we all hate commercials, they are a necessary evil these days. That's what keeps the show on the air. You can also show support by purchasing one of my many books, or donating through PayPal, or leaving a review on whatever platform you listen to this podcast on. You can find the links for the books or donation options in the podcast description, of course, as well as the links to the guest. As of always, a portion of the proceeds from this podcast do go to local organizations that help fight human trafficking.
Hey folks, welcome back to the podcast. As always, I am your host, Amanda Blackwood. Today I have a remarkable young lady. She has overcome a lot of her own traumas and she has written about her experiences. So I want to introduce Nicole Angelique Kerr. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Amanda. I am excited and delighted and most of all grateful to have that you are having me on your show today. And I look forward to our discussion.
I think your message is really important. I think a lot of people can get a lot of value out of that. I can't see somebody saying that they wouldn't want you on their show. I mean, what an incredible person you are. Oh my gosh. So let's start at the very beginning. Where are you originally from?
Jackson, Mississippi. So I'm a Southern girl. I grew up in the South, the Bible Belt, really religious area, and also very conservative. And very racially oriented. So I grew up going to parochial schools. Then I went into the public school system. And then I went back into a private school my last year and a half. So I had an experience of all different types of schooling. And then at that point, I am a recovering people pleaser. Some of you may identify with that. But people pleasing is an identity that we form usually early in life in order to get love and attention or affection or just noticed from our parents. And what I realized for me is that I was really a people pleaser in terms of my dad, my father. He was a former Marine, went to the U.S. Air Force Academy, wanted one of his children to go there. So I was the second of 4 siblings, and they just started admitting women. And I applied. Now, mind you, Amanda, I had no desire to go in the military. I was on a fashion board, a 17 magazine. I was their representative from Mississippi. I did junior achievement, ballet, things that had nothing to do with the military. So when I got accepted, I was like, oh my gosh, now I got to go. And I went out there, they chopped my hair off, they took away all my Estee Lauder and everything else, and put me in these fatigues and issued me everything except my bra, even took away my contact lenses. And so I went into boot camp, and I knew within the first 3 weeks when we got to call home that I was in the wrong place and my soul was in the wrong place. But we have a belief system in our Kerr family that you don't quit, that failure is not an option. And when you start something, no matter how much you hate it or don't want to do it, you continue until you finish. And so I could not bear the thought of just quitting and saying, this isn't for me. No matter how abusive it got, and it did get very abusive, I just said I had to keep sticking it out. And it really would have been beneficial if my parents, during the only phone call we had to make during boot camp, would have told me on that call, it was 3 minutes, Nicole, if this isn't for you, you have permission to come home. There's no shame attached to it. There's no, you're less, it's not that you're less than, you're not good enough. It's just not the right fit for you. If they could have explained that to me and said that, I would have quit in a New York minute, but they didn't. In fact, I cried the entire 3 minutes, and my commander said, okay, Kerr, there's your 3 minutes, and said, go over there and get yourself together. And years later, I realized I had a panic attack. That was my first panic attack because I knew that I was in fear every day, and the fear of, I was physically being abused. I was with women, it's sexual abuse, and that is still going on today in our military, unfortunately. And it is emotional abuse, the way they yell at you and call you horrible names. And as a freshman in any of these institutions, you just have to sit there and take it. You cannot fight back or say anything back. And so it was a real challenge for me physically as well. I'm not a varsity athlete, like I said. So I was struggling all the time. And my soul kept saying, you got to get out of this. This is not the right place. And I just couldn't do it. So fast forward to my second year there, I make it through the first year by the grace of God, get through Hell Week, get through the worst part, survival training. And then the beginning of my sophomore year, I was in a horrific car crash. I was a passenger, a senior cadet was driving. And needless to say, this is what I'm showing you, a picture of a 1965 Corvette convertible. And I was a passenger in it. And I did not survive this crash. I was thrown out and was pronounced dead at the scene. And that by the time the first responders got there, some bystanders had covered me up and said they couldn't get any vitals on me. And the paramedics came and took off the blanket and couldn't get any vitals on me either. So the last thing they did was this sternal knuckle press, which is what healthcare professionals do to elicit pain in the body. And at that moment, after being clinically dead for 10 to 13 minutes, my right pupil that flinched, the eyelid flinched and the pupil dilated. And have you ever heard of that saying, our eyes are the window to our soul?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. At that moment, Amanda, my soul, which had flown out when I went through the windshield, okay, it never hit my body. I don't recall it hitting the ground. I knew when it hit the ground, I was going to die. So my soul flew out at that moment when I was up in the air, and it came back when the paramedic was working on me. My soul came back through my right eye. And at that point, they were able to get a blood pressure reading on me of 60/0, which is still pretty much dead because normal is between 120/130/80. So they got me, did CPR all the way to the hospital, got me to the nearest community hospital. And it was just about stabilizing me that night. And it took them the entire night to stabilize me due to all my injuries. And I'm not going to go into all the injuries. They're detailed in my book, but just enough to tell you that I spent 4 months in a hospital, 7 weeks in ICU. I had to learn to walk again. When I was released, I was completely dependent on my mother for care and my dad. And it took me back to a state of infancy. And I developed a very codependent relationship with my mother because all my friends were off at their various colleges. And there was no one around except my mother and occasionally my father. So I had two near-death experiences during the hospital. And then the only thing I remember during that whole time was bright white lights. And that, if you know anything about near-death experiences, is the most common characteristic of people that do have them. That's Dr. Raymond Moody, who coined the term near-death experience, said that. And it was true for me. And I kept thinking, maybe it's the operating room lights. But no, it wasn't. My memory came back 19 years later. I had gone on and gotten a college degree, got an advanced degree in nutrition because as a result of not getting mental health help because of my trauma, the doctors told my parents, Nicole has been through a massive trauma. She needs psychiatry and psychology and mental health help. And they told them, because they're extremely religious, that Jesus was our psychiatrist and that she was going to be fine. And Amanda, I was anything but fine. When I stayed with my parents for a year, and I got to the point physically where I was operating okay. What they didn't know was mentally and spiritually, I was an absolute wreck. But I looked fine, and I could walk, and all my body parts were working, even though they had some issues. So they sent me to live with my sister in Dallas, and she's a year and a half older. And needless to say, she didn't get a roommate. She got a traumatized sister who needed help. And so that fractured our relationship, and I developed an eating disorder. And this is back in 1984, when eating disorders weren't really known, but it was compulsive eating back then. And I didn't understand why I would just stuff all this food in my face and then want to just go throw up. I couldn't throw up, but I wanted to. And it was just, it was just horrible. I hated myself so much because my parents blamed me for the cause of the crash, even though I wasn't driving, even though I wasn't drinking. He was an alcoholic. I later found out he was double the limit on alcohol. And he later, when my memory came back, was trying to make a sexual pass at me. And I said no. And he got angry with me and jerked the steering wheel of the Corvette, and it spun out fishtailed and hit a boulder, flipped the Corvette. It landed on its top. We were thrown out, and he was conscious, had some injuries on his back. And needless to say, I went into a ditch and was pronounced dead. So it's ironic to me that my parents, my dad's rules were no smoking, no drinking, and no dating upperclassmen. Well, I didn't date my entire high school career. Okay. I was finally having some fun in my life. I was like, this guy was like, hey, you know, I was getting a ride back to the academy. He wanted to stop at a bar, have a couple of beers. I was like, oh, cool. Here, Nicole, have a cigarette, try smoking. Oh, okay. And then it was like, let's stop at the rock, you know, this lookout point at the Rocky Mountains. I didn't realize he had an entire agenda about getting me drunk and having sex when I asked him to just take me back to the academy. So that all came back 19 years later. And I had wondered for years why I could not have a healthy relationship with a guy. I was scared of their anger. So the people pleasing really kicked in. And now I realized any guy I thought I got angry would potentially kill me. That's how the brain worked. So I aimed to please every guy that I ever dated, and I couldn't understand that. And so I didn't get married until age 40. My memory came back at 38. So it only took one guy after that I dated. And then I met my now husband. So these suppressed memories, in my opinion, come up when your body feels safe and when you feel like you have support. And at that point in my life, I had a sense of safety. I had support to get the resources that I needed to help with trauma. Because if you don't have a family that supports you with trauma, it's going to be judgment and criticism and dismissal or disregard of what you're going through. You're fine. Just get on with it. And that's why I tell people, if your parents have been traumatized, and most have, if they don't heal their trauma wounds, they have no empathy, sympathy, or compassion for your trauma and what you're going through.
Oh my gosh. And amen.
Yes. So you have to heal it for the next generation and for yourself. And that is, there's no way out of that. You have to go through it. And that's why I call my near-death experience a spiritual transformation, because I grew up in a religious household. My mother was Lutheran, my dad Southern Baptist. So I had a lot of church, but I also was raised with the concept of God that instilled a level of fear in me that if I disobeyed God or my father, that I would go to hell and burn in eternity down there. So when you're instilled with fear as a young child, and then you continue to fear all through your adolescent years, then you go to a military academy where there's more fear, right? Fear has been running my system. And fear is that part, fight, flight, or freeze, your amygdala. And when that takes over and runs your system, you lose clarity. And in order to regain your clarity, you've got to address your fears. And that's one of my main messages that I was given on the other side was to tell people not to be afraid of death. So when I actually died at 19, that's the concept of God I had. And I feared God, and I feared that I was a bad person for getting in the car with somebody that was drunk. I should have known better. Shame on me. And turns out that that actually wasn't the truth. 38 years later, my roommate at the time, we get together on a Zoom call. I've not talked to her in the entire time. She quit the academy. And last May, and I put this in the epilogue of the book because it's so important. She told me, "Nicole, I'm so sorry I caused the crash." I said, "What do you mean you caused it?" She said, "We had agreed we would ride back together from this squadron event. And at the last minute, one of the seniors, they'd all been drinking and he was too drunk to drive his car home back to the academy. So I was going to drive it back for him, but I really liked him and I wanted to make out with him, but I didn't want you around. So I told you there was one other car left, this guy that had this Corvette convertible, and you said he'd been drinking. And I told you, well, they all have been drinking, so don't worry about it. Go have some fun and I'll see you back at the academy." Well, she never did. And so she quit because she could not live with the guilt, and it has haunted her for 38 years. And I said, "Why didn't you ever tell me?" She thought, "I thought you remembered that and that you didn't want to have anything to do with me. You were so angry with me." So we were able to heal that. But what it told me was, okay, I knew that they had been drinking. I was trying to have some fun in my life. And boom, did I get slammed the first time that I actually let myself do it. And so my father took that as I disobeyed him and let my other siblings know, this is what happens when you don't listen to your father. What happened to Nicole? So that's the parenting model that I grew up in. Very controlling, very strict, very religious, very dogmatically positioned, that my father knew what was best for all of us. And we just never got to think on our own what it is we wanted to do. So surviving that crash was not of me. It was something greater than me that intervened. And when my memory came back, I was working at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I went into nutrition because I thought if I went into nutrition, I could fix my eating disorder, right? A lot of us go into areas that we have our own issues with, thinking that we're going to fix them if we can just figure this out. And I thought it was just a food issue. I just can't stop eating. I had no idea that it was a mental issue. It was a mental disorder. And so I did get my registered dietitian. And wouldn't you know, I go into helping eating disorders because that's what I knew. So ironically, I did that for a number of years, then branched out into emotional wellness because I realized a lot of people I put diets on when they got stressed, they would revert back to old behaviors and eat that pint of Ben and Jerry's. And I realized that there's something else going on. And it's these unconscious belief systems that we are still operating with on an unconscious level. And that's the part of the brain that we have to start addressing. Otherwise, you're going to sabotage yourself from becoming the person that you want to be. You're not going to be able to make these changes because the belief system is stuck in you at such a core level. And it takes work. And that's why this transformation work, it's not for the faint of heart, because I had to totally reconceptualize my entire life. I had to let go of my family of origin. My parents, I now do not have a relationship with. I had an angel come, and when I flew through the windshield, the angel, I call him Casper, the friendly ghost in the book, and he's male, and he took me to, you might want to call it heaven or whatever this space is above, and it was absolutely beyond brilliance. And I know death is a topic in our society we don't like to talk about. We're in death denial in our country. We don't think it's going to happen to us. and we don't prepare for it. And that is what I want to tell people, is that you need to start preparing yourself, because death is going to happen to you. It is a shared experience, and it's going to happen to your loved ones. And it's important. Most writers that write about death talk about the doom and the gloom part of it. And we think of death as depressing and negative. And what I'm trying to do is to change the narrative and to the view and the vibration and the cultural misunderstanding surrounding death. And to do this, we have to start addressing the difficulties getting there, which are our fears. And most of these fears are unconscious. And so it takes maybe some additional help with different modalities to get at these beliefs, whether it's neuroemotional technique, EMDR, hypnotherapy, biofeedback, but they're in your body, just like your emotions. If they're not expressed, stay in your body. And at some point will cause dis-ease to try to get your attention for you to resolve them, because they are keeping you in a pattern that is not serving you for your highest and greatest good.
Did writing your book help you to kind of process through some of this stuff and to move beyond it?
Absolutely. And I took my book took 13 years to write. Goodness. Okay. And so when people say, are you going to write another one? I'm like, not unless it gets channeled through me, but to have to go through that, I was very disconnected from my head and my body. And I had to go, I went into neuroemotional technique and realized that I had a very limited range of emotions growing up. I was not allowed to get angry. I was not allowed to hurt my mother. There were certain things that you just did not allow yourself to feel. And I think as a country, we're pretty illiterate emotionally. Most of us grow up with mad, sad, bad, and glad. And you have to, what I realized with NET, it transformed my healing process for me, because it helped me to understand what the emotion was that I'm feeling now, because I had such a hard time identifying it. Because in the military, they teach you not to feel. It's either black or white. There's no gray area for feelings. And so military people have a real difficult time in relationships and trying to express their emotions. And it is, it's a problem. And it's a problem for a lot of people, because they're told earlier on, you know, these beliefs that are not true, you know, about emotions. And so I am now able to do this to myself. When I get triggered, I can understand what the trigger is. And then I can go back in my body and figure out when it first started. And most of the time, it's going to be around age six, because age six is where you start to individuate as a child. You get on the school bus by yourself. You don't need mommy to get on the school bus, right? And all these things. So if you're not allowed as a child to individuate, that becomes a problem. And if you're filled with fear and you compound that with not being able to individuate, you have to find a way, like people pleasing or whatever it is, to compensate for that. The other age that comes up a lot in going back is age 16, where you think you know who you are, but when you try to go out and be that person, you get told, no, you're no good at it. No, you're never going to make money as an artist. You're never going to make money as a musician. You got to go into something that's going to be more secure and safe. And so you're dismissed in terms of what your voice is saying, and you have no support. So without that, as a 16-year-old, you're going to have to go into a different pathway, unless you are a super strong person who can find a way to do that and have parents who will support you with that. But most of our generation did not have that. Parents today, I think, are a lot more attuned to that need. But to me, and then it can also go back generationally, because trauma is inherited generationally and ancestrally. It can be passed on. And so sometimes you make it may come up that this is a generational issue, and you have to clear that for you, your mother, your grandmother. All of you acted the same way in terms of you always have to look good in order for a man to like you. You grew up with that, and you had to look a certain way. You can't go out of the house in your yoga pants, you know, first impressions or lasting impressions, you know, all these sayings that you hear, and you really do internalize them. And then the other piece of this is it could be a past life. And most people are just starting to look at past lives and whether or not they had one or how much that's influencing their current life. But I will tell you, our soul incarnates. We're only on this earth for a very short period of time in these physical bodies. And death can occur at any moment, at any time. No one's guaranteed the next hour or the next tomorrow. And I think a lot of these mass shootings are bringing that to people's awareness. They go out shopping, they go to the theater, they go somewhere, and then they never come home, you know, and it is instilling even more fear in people to have to live like this. And fear, again, is a low vibration. It causes you not to make the best decision for your well-being. And you're dealing most of the time with irrationality with these fears. But you have to be able to look at what the belief system is and become aware of it, because if you're not aware of it, then you just keep repeating it. And that's the clue, is once you become aware of something, you're not going to be able to go back and keep doing the same behavior. So it's really, really important to address. Every single one of us has pushed down emotions at some point in our life, and we need to go back and we need to free ourselves from that and just allow ourselves to realize, oh my God, there's so much grief built up over the years and I had to look at that with my crash, because I lost my family that I thought I knew at that point. I lost the relationship with my parents. I thought I owed them. You know, my mother came out, I give her credit, and stayed with me the 4 months in the hospital and then the 8 months of rehab. But then when she dropped me off at my sister's place, she never hardly called. It was just like she was done with me. And it was so hard for me to make sense of that, you know, because I was so fragile emotionally, and my mental health was at such a teetering point. I had anxiety, I had depression, and I had PTSD way back then, but they didn't acknowledge any of that, you know. They sent me to a 12-step program for compulsive overeaters, and that did not exactly help me, because of all the addictions, food is the one you have to keep eating, right? The rest of them you can do without.
You can't quit that cold turkey.
Yeah. You got to eat. So it's been a journey in all the domains of wellness. And to survive it, my spirit is so strong. And I have now, I have a relationship with my soul, which I never even really understood at 19. All I knew was soul food and soul music, and the wrath of God would come on your soul if you screwed up, you know? So I understand now what my soul is and what a concept called soul loss. When you're traumatized, your soul will fragment, okay? And it does that to protect yourself. And here are some of the symptoms. If you have soul loss, you don't want to be here. Well, I certainly didn't want to come back when I was on the other side. When Casper, who later turned out to be, I just realized this last August, my grandfather on my father's side, who ironically on earth was an alcoholic. So I am in a car crash with an alcoholic. And then my grandfather comes to me. I smelled cigar smoke while I was riding one day. And I'm going, where is this cigar smoke coming from? Nobody in my household smoked cigars. And then I just closed my eyes to meditate and I heard his voice. And he said, he died at 58 years old in August, mid-August. And I was 58 at that time. And it was right around when he died. And he said, Nicole, it's now time for me to tell you, I was the angel that came down and saved you. I had seen what was going on. I was seeing the abuse that you were suffering. And I came down and picked you up and took you to the other level. So Casper, I had the right elements. You know, I knew it was a male. I knew he was in his 30s, but I never knew it was my grandfather. So, and everything he did on earth, none of that transferred up to where he was in heaven. You know, none of that carries over. And so he told me he would be with me until I passed away. He would be a protective angel for me. So we all have angels, in case you didn't know that. Each of us has a guardian angel assigned to us, and some of us have more. And when I got to the other side, it was really clear. Now, mind you, I'm not in human form. I'm in this spirit, you know, this energy form that leaves you. When you die, you have an energy body. We're all energy, and it cracks from the top down, and your soul is released. Okay. So that soul part that was up there with my angel James, I could hear other angels and other guides communicating. Now, they're not talking English, so it's a vibration and I'm having to interpret this. And they were saying, please ask us for help. We are here for you. And they're meaning us humans. Okay. They are not going to interfere unless they're asked, because we have something called free will in this country. We have a choice, but they are there and they're ready, willing, and able to help every single one of us, and not just in a crisis. They are there even for a parking space. As crazy and as minute as that may be, yes, you can ask them for help with a parking space. So I tell people, before you go to bed tonight, just whatever it is that you want help with from the angelic realm, just ask. And you can ask, okay, I have a guardian angel. I'm going to suspend my disbelief and believe that they're there. Can you tell me your name? Or can you give me any information about yourself or anything that you want to know? And what you do is you start developing a relationship with the angelic realm. And it is amazing how your life changes, because you realize you're not alone and they have your best interest always at heart. So that was the first message. And the second one was, he told me I was going to go back in my body. And I was like, no, 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 no. I looked at that body down there and I was like, it was mangled. I'm like, I'm not going back in that. I don't want to go back in that body. And I don't want to be put back into a state of infancy to be cared for by my parents, who are going to be going back to the church and praising God and Jesus that I'm on this miracle. I just didn't, and I didn't know what my life would look like in terms of my physical and mental capacity. So he said, yes, you are. And your message is going to be to tell people not to be afraid of death. And I was like, now that's a pretty big message. How in the world am I going to do that? That's 20 years, basically, into later, I get this message. It has taken me now, Amanda, another 20 years to integrate what that mission was that spirit gave me when my memory returned. And while seemingly a quite simple message, it has taken me almost 4 decades to understand what that looks like for me. And now I understand that purpose, and I have shifted my focus toward the spirituality that is essential to wellness, because wellness has been my career, but I focus more in the physical, what to eat, get your physical activity, you know, rest. Then I went into the emotions with NET and the mental part of that. And now I'm in the last quadrant, which to me is the most profound and healing, which is spirituality. So my own experience, along with hundreds of thousands of other near-death experiencers, is 100% different than the doom and gloom that's written about. Death is absolute beauty, light, loving kindness, and this natural everlasting peace on the other side. And don't misunderstand me. In our human form, there's still suffering, there's still grief, pain, loss that we have to, you know, carefully and compassionately hold and heal for one another. But when you can look at the greater cosmic context, it's extraordinary. And knowing that true context enables us to live a happier life and to prepare for our own graceful passing and to support others as they approach their own transition. And that is, if we can die without that fear, it is so much more beautiful.
For people who are looking for more information about Nicole or about Nicole's book, you can always visit her website, which is www.NicoleKerr.com, or you can find her links to Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn in the descriptions of the podcast below. You can find her book all over the internet, and it's called You Are Deathless. Please take a moment to check out Nicole's books when you get a moment. If you've enjoyed tonight's episode, please make sure you check out the episode description. There you'll find links on how you can learn more about this guest, links to connect with them on social media, and how to support the podcast. Remember, I don't get paid to do this. My boss is a bit tight-fisted. I can say that. I work for myself. In short, this show really is all about the guest. If you've enjoyed their interview, please feel free to let them know. You can also tune in to my other podcast, Growth from Darkness, which is co-hosted by a lovely lady from Australia. We talk about what trauma responses are and healthy ways to move beyond the past. For more information, just go to growthfromdarkness.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/growthfromdarkness.